We're learning about an invasive earthworm introduced from Eastern Asia called crazy worms or jumping worms here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Scientists say these unusual worms are a danger to our forests, our animals, and plants. And over the years, they've spread to more than a dozen states, including here in Wisconsin. Have you come across a so-called crazy worm? Where did you see it? What did you observe? What do you want to know about these worms? It's 800-642-1234. Brad Herrick is an ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. Brad, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with a visual in our mind's eye, if you will. What do these worms look like?
So to the, I guess, the untrained eye, they look just like every other earthworm, you know, similar to the night crawler that we're used to for fishing. But where they're invaded, they are much, much more abundant. And since they really only live in the top few centimeters of soil, they're much more apparent because you just see them much more often. But generally, they're just kind of a brownish red worm. As adults, though, the biggest difference is that they have this white ring near their head. It's called the clitellum, and it's where they produce these cocoons, their offspring. And when I give talks to Master Gardener, to other folks, I always emphasize this white ring because that's by far the easiest way to identify them.
That's their defining feature, yeah. What about their movements and behavior? Do they actually jump?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's the other thing that we talk about, too, is they are called jumping worms commonly for a reason. And they don't, you know, they don't have legs, so they're not jumping like you and I might think of jumping, but they thrash around quite a bit. And they can, you know, they have more of a rigid body than other earthworms. And so because of that anatomy, they can lift themselves off the ground just by flopping around and thrashing. And so it appears that they are jumping, but they don't have legs. So they're not, you know, actually jumping. But the other behavior is that they act like a snake sometimes. So they're also called snake worms.
Mm-hmm.
And they do this S, kind of like snakes do, to get away from predators. They just make the S shape as they're scooting away. So, and some of them are really long. And so I've had folks thinking that they have these new weird snakes in their garden when they're just these new creepy earthworms.
So they can actually get bigger than we would imagine our typical earthworm. You know, I saw this video of you holding one, and as you touched it, it would jump. And I wonder, does it respond to touch?
Yeah, right. So we don't know a lot about sort of the reasons for that behavior, other than it's likely has to do with disturbance or getting away from predators. So, right, if you unearth one, so to speak, it may not exhibit that jumping or snake behavior until you touch it and kind of, you know, not to anthropomorphize earthworms, but annoy it a little bit. And then that's when it'll likely exhibit that thrashing behavior or snaking behavior. That's when you would most likely see it, when it gets disturbed.
And Brad, give us some historical reference here on where they came from and when they arrived here in Wisconsin.
Right. So depending on there's many species of jumping worms. In fact, there's hundreds of different species. And in North America, we have about 17 different species. And they're generally from Southeastern Asia, China, the Korean Peninsula, and Japan. And interestingly enough, there's been records of a couple of species of jumping worms in the lower 48 back to the turn of the 20th century.
Maine said they found one in a greenhouse in 1899.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. So some of them are not necessarily new, quote unquote, invaders or, you know, earthworms to the continent. However, for whatever reason, those early introductions did not become invasive. They did not spread. And, you know, they've been down in the southeast part of the country as well. Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, for decades. And for whatever reason, though, the last 15 years or so, 20 years, they've really started to move. They've moved up the eastern seaboard, now to the Midwest. And we actually have records of them being in about 37 states now.
Wow.
You know, we don't know why all of a sudden there was some threshold, some trigger that really, you know, expanded their range. You know, it's potentially some climate change happening, or just, you know, densely populated areas and moving of materials that have these jumping worms in them, or their cocoons just happened, and they've taken advantage of it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with ecologist Brad Herrick of UW-Madison's Arboretum about these jumping worms, and he assists in developing long-term restoration plans for Arboretum lands. You can join in. Do you have jumping worms in your area or in your backyard? What would you like to know about them? What have you observed? 800-642-1234. Brad, getting into the ecology here, what threat do these worms have on Wisconsin forests?
Right. So we're just sort of you know, touching the surface now of the potential impacts of this new invasive species, yet another invasive species to Wisconsin. And, you know, what we know kind of so far is that they drastically change the soil. So in terms of the soil chemistry, how nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus that are really important for plant growth, they change the availability of those nutrients, often reducing them in the soil. And they change the structure of the soil. So this is another key way to tell if you have jumping worms or not. In your yard or in a forest, without actually seeing the worms, because they leave in their wake a what we think is a permanent structural change in the soil. It looks like coffee grounds, or I've heard it described as taco meat, which is, I think, a less appealing way to think about it. But very granular, just little beads of soil that, from what we can tell, do not hold moisture as well. Is highly erodible and are high in nutrients, but those nutrients are tied up in these little beads of soil and are not able to get down to the root zone. And so that's one of the biggest changes that we're seeing. And, you know, we don't know, because this is a relatively new invasion, we still don't know what the long-term impacts of just the soil changes might be to plant growth, to amphibians that are using the soil, to other soil arthropods. And so that's still out there. We haven't seen any drastic changes to the plant community, although there is some indication. It's a different story in gardens. I'm hearing lots of stories about garden plants, whether they're ornamentals or natives, struggling. A lot of the impacts to forests are still unknown.
Lots of question marks.
Soil structure changes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Well, let's take a call. Patty is joining us in Sheboygan. Hi, Patty.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. We live on 8 acres of a wooded property, and some of the acreage does have stunts. I do have ornamental flowers. I did notice jumping worms in my beds. Is it true if you slice them in half with a shovel that you'll now have two growing? And then my second question is, if I pour like an ammonia or a vinegar in the soil, will that help kill the ache?
Patty, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Patty. Good question. So I get this first question a lot. If you slice earthworm in half, do you now have two earthworms? And the answer is absolutely not. That will probably kill the earthworm, although they can survive with just being a shorter earthworm as long as their clitellum, that reproductive area, is still intact. So you are not creating two earthworms. Don't worry about that. And then the other question about pouring vinegar or an ammonia product into your soil. Folks are trying that. I don't know much about the ammonia application, but I have heard that a vinegar and water solution will definitely, on contact at least, will definitely kill the earthworms.
In what proportions, approximately?
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty low rate. You don't need much. Now, a caveat there is that we do not know the impacts of doing this kind of work on plants, on soil pH. They likely have other impacts that we don't know yet. And so I just kind of caution people to maybe try it in an area and just see what kind of impact they're seeing in terms of plant health. It will not affect cocoons, though. That's the problem with a lot of these applications, is that these cocoons have a hard shell, and we have not found anything as of yet that can penetrate that shell. But there is work that will be starting up hopefully pretty soon on looking at that part of their life cycle.
Yeah, we're going to look more at their reproduction with Brad Herrick, who's explaining crazy worms or jumping worms. He is a UW-Madison Arboretum ecologist. Do you have jumping worms in your area? What would you like to know about them? Have you had a problem with these worms? What did they do to your soil? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Brad Herrick here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss the effects of crazy worms. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers have been studying what these invasive worms will do to the health of our forests and how to control established populations. Gardeners, what are your observations of these worms and what have you done to control them? According to the state of Maine's horticulture program, crazy worms are native to Korea and Japan and are now found from Maine to South Carolina and westward to our state. What is your experience with them? Have you come across them sold as fishing bait? Join in 800-642-1234. We have ecologist Brad Herrick, who is research manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum, with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Brad, can you explain their life cycle and how they reproduce?
Yes, definitely. And this is one way that we can separate them from all other earthworms that we might see in our environment. They have an annual life cycle. And so in the spring, they hatch from these little 2-millimeter cocoons that look just like soil. So they're very hard to see in the soil. They will hatch in those cocoons. And in about 2 months or so, they become mature. And so by mid-summer, you're going to start right about now. You're going to start to see a lot of these mature earthworms, and then they will, as far as we know, just kind of periodically produce cocoons. Mm-hmm. And until the first hard freeze, usually in our part of the state, sometime in mid-October. Once that happens, then the adult worms, all the earthworms, will die. But those cocoons will survive our winter, and they'll overwinter until the next spring where they'll hatch again. And so it is a true annual life cycle, which is pretty remarkable for this this invasive species that, you know, there are no alive earthworms for a bulk of the year, but yet they can still spread and be quite abundant during the summer.
Yeah, so they have like these winter tents that hold them over.
That's right. Yeah. It's pretty remarkable. And, you know, they can produce many cocoons each individually. And if you have a high abundance of earthworms, you have a lot of cocoons. And it's very different than other earthworms that are able to dig into the soil below the frost line and survive. And so that's one of the reasons why we talk about that a lot, is because if people see large earthworms in like April or May, those are very unlikely to be jumping worms because they haven't matured yet. And so those are going to be some other type of earthworms at that point of year.
Well, you know, Brad, there are so many different invasive plants and animals out there that invade our natural habitat in, you know, countless ways. Where do crazy worms fall in the continuum of least concerning to most concerning invasive?
Well, I'm probably biased here, but I think they're up near the top at this point. And they're still somewhat unknown, surprisingly. But the reason why they're still unknown, it's likely because they're pretty cryptic, right? They're earthworms, and so you don't you may not see them in the soil if you're just walking through the forest, like you would buckthorn or a stand of ash trees that's been attacked by emerald ash borer, garlic mustard is very obvious, and so but the damage that they can do to the soil and how quickly they are moving throughout the U.S. and into Canada. I think really puts them near the top of these new invaders, and the fact that they are spreading faster, and there's more questions from the public than we have answers to. And so that's what makes them even particularly more, you know, scary, is that we don't know what the long-term effects are. We don't know a lot of these basic biology questions, because, you know, this is a new invasive. And so we're trying to get up to speed with answers.
Well, researchers also think perhaps that these worms threaten sugar maple trees. And in Wisconsin, of course, we produce hundreds of thousands of gallons of maple syrup a year. Are you concerned these worms could affect maple syrup output?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, sugar maple is a very common tree, not only in Wisconsin, but throughout the upper Midwest and New England. Maple syrup, as well as, you know, just hardwood, other uses for maple wood. So yeah, that's definitely a concern. And there are some studies going on in Vermont and other places looking at potential, you know, how do they affect sugar maple establishment? Mm-hmm. And how do they affect just their growth and health, and, you know, trickling down to the more commodity, the sugar maple or the maple syrup manufacturing. So yeah, that's definitely one of the sort of biggest concerns that we have, is just with that resource, which affects, you know, a big part of the economy.
We're talking with ecologist Brad Herrick of UW-Madison's Arboretum, explaining the effects of non-native jumping worms in Wisconsin, the spread of these worms in North America. Do you have jumping worms? Have you ever seen one? What have been the effects to your soil, to your garden, to your landscape? 800-642-1234. Brad, at this point in trying to get tackle the biology and start answering a lot of these questions, how important is the citizen science, the observations at this point?
They are critical, to be honest. They're spreading at such a rate that, you know, scientists alone or even graduate students cannot, you know, track them fast enough and learn enough at large scales. And so community science, citizen science is absolutely critical. And that's a good segue maybe into a project that I wanted to plug. And that is, we have a new project that just started. It's a jumping worm survey and outreach project that is funded through a Baldwin grant through campus. And the idea with this is to engage the gardening community in Wisconsin to tell us just simply, what are you observing in your backyard garden, in your community garden? And so we're looking for participants to help just to do a survey and maybe a follow-up focus group, so that we can kind of, as a community, create a network and share our observations. And the end result of this project is hopefully to create a list of plants that, you know, may have some resilience to jumping worm effects, and maybe a list of plants that we know are really impacted, whether it's plant families or plant traits that, you know, gardeners should avoid in their landscaping or in their vegetable growing. And so if there's folks listening that are interested in being a part of this, if you go to our website, arboretum.wisc.edu, right front and center is a picture of a jumping worm, and you can click on that, and it'll take you to a link to sign up for that survey when it comes out.
Yeah, we also have that link at wpr.org/mornings. Let's bring in John in Glendale. John, hi.
Hi, good morning. I was wondering if these worms are a problem in their native lands, and if so, how they control them.
Yeah, that's a great question, John, and I get that one a lot too. And so with just like other invasive species, where they, you know, every species is native to somewhere, and in their native areas, just like jumping worms, they are often not an issue. And that's the case with this group of earthworms. You know, in Japan and Korea, where the ones we have in the U.S. are mostly found, they are not a problem. And they're actually not found very often in forests. They're more often found on the edge of forests or in meadows. And they, you know, we don't know why they're not invasive necessarily in their native land, other than there's probably some sort of native biological control, whether it's a fungus, animal species. There's many different species of jumping worms, and so there might be some sort of, you know, intra-species competition that keeps them all in check. And, you know, they just don't have whatever it is, that predator, that environmental change is not here. And so they found a niche to take over, and they do it very well. It's a great question. We don't know exactly why they're not invasive in their native range, but that's often the case with these species that become invasive here.
Well, Brad, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kate.
Brad Herrick, he is an ecologist and research program manager at the UW-Madison Arboretum. We have a link to that Arboretum's Jumping Worm Survey outreach that is underway, as Brad talked about. Find it at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we discuss virtual reality police training and how it's helping agencies respond to crisis situations. Has your police department or your organization ever used a VR simulator for training? What did you think of it? What were the outcomes? 800-642-1234 to join in. News update is next here on the Ideas Network.